KPI.org.
This is KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org. Thank you for joining Disability and Progress, where we bring you insights into, ideas about, and discussions on disability topics. My name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. Thanks for tuning in. Miguel Vargas is my engineer today. Aaron Westendorp is my podcaster. And Charlene Dahl is my PR and everything else person. Hi, Charlene.
Hi, everybody.
This week, we are speaking with author Mickey Carolyn. Mickey is the writer of the book Mom, Dad, Not Here, H-E-A-R. And he is going to talk to us about that book and about growing up, learning lessons of love and valuable things. So, hi, Mickey. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
I just want to start out by asking you because, you know, I found your story very interesting, and you're actually the second person that I've known who's grown up kind of being in the situation you were in. And the other person had a very large family and he was in your very similar situation. I always find those things very fascinating because, being a parent, you know, with a disability and having a sighted child, I feel like there was not exactly the same thing, but, you know, things cross over in a sort of way. So I'm curious to know why you felt the need to write this book, and was this your first writing?
Yeah, so great question. And what happened was roughly 10 years ago, I actually wrote most of the bones of this book. I wrote it as part of National Novel Writing Month back in 2014, and I let it sit for nearly 10 years, and then my father passed in 2021, and the final words I said in his eulogy were, "Dad, your work here is done. We have your legacy from here. I love you." And ever since that point in time, I've said to myself, "What can I do?" So, last year I used my one word for the year, which was the word finish. And I went back and I said, I'm going to finish this book. Now, I took a little detour and wrote a couple children's books, one inspired by my father, one inspired by my mother. But I finished the book. Now, I didn't publish it in 2023 based off the timing. I didn't want it to get lost in the Christmas holiday season. But that's where I was called to say, you know what, let's put my family's story down on paper, because when I look back at it, I can answer questions about my grandparents. I can answer a little bit of questions about my great-grandparents. Once you get beyond my great-grandparents, I don't have a ton of history. And once my parents are, my mother's gone, once we're gone, the generations down the line can physically hold up the book and read it. So that's ultimately how I came to writing this.
Excellent. Thank you. You also talk about the need to capitalize the word death. I know in some countries they've done other things like capitalizing the word Braille for blind people, but could you give us a little bit of insight on that?
Yeah, so that was the whole basis of my author's note in the front page of the book. So I grew up in a capital D deaf culture. My parents identified as being deaf. So when they do that, it's a capital D. Now, with that being said, I know a lot of folks can be, they have differing opinions on it. So the whole point for me was, hey, look, if you find a capital D that maybe looks grammatically out of place and you don't understand the backstory behind it, my whole premise was, I have nothing but love. So please do not take the grammar, the capitalization, or the not capitalization out of context. It was a matter of that's how I was raised and how I refer to it, because there are a lot of readers, not just that have zero exposure to the deaf community. So if they're reading the book and they see a capital D mm-hmm. in the middle of a sentence, grammatically, they're going to think, wait a minute, that doesn't feel right, doesn't seem right. So that was why I took that one right on the head in the beginning of the book, is this is what's going on. This is why, no ill will. This is, please, no disrespect meant.
It is interesting to me. I guess I feel like you can offend anybody much of the time sometimes nowadays. But, I have a lot of respect for authors and why they choose to do what they do. And unless they pound me over the head with something blatantly offensive, I just don't really, it's like everyone has their own thing that they're doing and why they're doing it. So I'm wondering, you talk, with your book, how did you, it's Mom, Dad, Not Here. How did you decide on the name of it?
So the name is actually the third iteration of the name. So I wrote the name, the work in progress manuscript nearly 10 years ago. It was written under one name. And then I dusted it off. And I renamed it this past year when I was writing it. But then ultimately how it came to be was one of my beta readers, he's an author, mentor, friend of mine, Wayne Walker, who he writes children's sports series books. And he said, Mickey, your title here, I have no idea what, until I read this book, I had no idea what CODA means, Child of Deaf Adults. He said, if I walked by it and I saw the word CODA on the book, I keep walking by. You need something that's gonna catch my attention, right? And I said, wait, that makes sense. There's not a lot of people that understand what CODA means. So then I thought about it, contemplated it, and I realized, wait a minute, it was staring me right in the face in chapter one. Mom, Dad, Not Here was to be the title of this book, and that's how it came to be. All from that one critique and conversation.
That's interesting, because that was the next question I was going to ask you, the meaning of CODA. I was like, okay, I've heard that word before, and until I got through your book, kind of, I never really realized what that was. And so Child of Deaf Adults.
That's correct.
Excellent. Well, it's good to have constructive criticism, right? So I guess you thank your friend.
Yeah, it was a moment in the build out and publishing of this book.
I'm wondering what the first time was that you really realized the important your interpreting made between your parents and an event.
Yeah, so that's really hard to pinpoint to an exact time, but I will tell you, the very first time I realized that communication was important, and clear communication is important, was when I was 4 years old. At the age of four, the phone rang. It was a yellow rotary dial phone, and I picked it up and I answered. And they said, "Is Mr. Carlin there?" I said, "Mom, Dad, not here." They said, "Excuse me, what'd you say?" I said, "Mom, Dad, not here." They hung up. Now, 15 minutes later, after I'd sat down and started watching cartoons, there was a knock on the door. There were two police officers there checking as a child welfare case.
Uh-oh.
I talk about that in chapter one, and the reality of it is that in that moment in time, I realized the way that we communicate is important. I had no idea there was a difference between H-E-R-E and H-E-A-R.
Ah, interesting, yeah. Well, and I think that's interesting that you say that because, you know, most children wouldn't, right? Kids are pretty black and white, and the gray is not there yet. And also, multiple meanings of a word is often not there, along with many other things. You know, they just don't realize. So that is very true, that's a huge difference can be made with one difference of a word. You talk about in your book, and I think there was a inscription written in your book too that said life challenges can, you know, either strengthen you or crush you. And it's up to you, you know, to how you decide to interpret those circumstances. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, so what you're speaking of is the endorsement by a fellow CODA friend of mine and Bill McKendry. And he was one of the first CODAs to read the book in advance. And that was his feedback. It was ultimately, you know, in the moment, in various moments as we grow up through our lives, the reality is you're going to have things that can either, you know, help you grow, or they could break. It's all how you put it in perspective. And I thought that was such a great endorsement on when I look at the travels from when I was a young child all the way through my teen years into my 20s, 30s, now in my 40s, the evolution of my mindset towards how I was raised has changed over time, right? There was this period of time where early on I thought it was cool to interpret for my parents all the time. Then you get into the teenage years and you want to, you know, kind of be like a normal kid. And then you realize, hey, you're not necessarily normal. You still have this interpreting that you have to do on the diet that helps you. So you have more than two choices. You either have a choice of you realize then and there, and you know, you have a unique experience and you can make a difference early on. That was not me. That was and there's in the CODA world, there are folks that travel one of two paths. They either take it full-fledged and they are what's referred to as a heritage signer. They become an interpreter, an advocate of some sort, or they take it to where I did. I had to take a step back a little bit. I was burnt out a little bit. I took a step back. And then, like I tell people, it took 40 plus years and the loss of my father to realize how unique my story was and the opportunity for me to share how that shapes myself as a leader out in the world.
So but reading your book sounds like you still did an awful lot of the mediation, I'll call it, between your parents and the hearing society. So did it make you angry? And if so, like, how did you resolve those feelings while you were doing it? While you were having to mediate,
right? So during my teenage years, right, it was a scenario where, and in some of the cardinal sins when you're interpreting is never mind, or I'll tell you later, right?
A huge insult, right?
Yes, and I was very guilty of that as a teenager. Like someone would tell me something, and my mother or father would ask me, what did they say? I said, oh, never mind, not a big deal, right? And, you know, which is that I look back at and realize how much of a jerk I was from that perspective. Mm-hmm. Now, you interpret everything, right? Obviously, interpreters are bound by a code of ethics to do that. Whereas I got a little bit too comfortable in that interpreting skin of mm-hmm. making decisions for them. So I really look back and if that was one thing I would change as a teenager, it's handling that better. And for anyone that listens that is in a situation where English is the second language, it doesn't have to be sign language. It could be Spanish, it could be French, it could be you name it.
Right.
If you're a child in that situation where you're finding yourself interpreting, understand that you have an opportunity. And please try not to be the jerk and all, but do it the right way. And that's one thing.
Yeah, well, I'm quite sure you are not alone. It's very hard fitting into an adult's shoes as you're a kid. And, you know, I feel like some people just do it more than others. I'm wondering, you also talk about being a chameleon, and like a chameleon is to me something I've often heard in a negative way, that people use it, but you really twist it and put it towards, you really shine a positive light on it. Talk about how you see that.
Yeah,
being able to be a chameleon.
And great question. That piece is, I believe, a foundational piece as to how versatile I am in the various roles I've had in my career and how I lead teams. And you are correct in the sense that from a a stigma perspective, it usually does have a negative connotation. And I looked at it and said, well, the reality was that's exactly what happened. Every time I was playing with my friends, we'd be somewhere playing, and my parents were around, and an adult came up and needed to talk to my parents, I would have to shed my kid's skin, as I refer to in the book, and put on my adult skin, go over there and interpret, take a break from mm-hmm. playing, go over there and do that. And because I had to do that, it made me so aware of the situation, the situational awareness, that I realized, you know what? You don't have to be a finite specialist. That's just not how I'm wired. I like different situations. I like different scenarios. And that's what I believe led me to having numerous rotations and different leadership roles within the company I'm at and from a board perspective.
You know, that's interesting. I suspect that as much as you felt like maybe you stuck out when you were a kid, and some kids always would maybe point you out as being the odd one, that there were probably just as many that quietly really admired you, that you were able to just do that and step out and communicate, you know, between your parents and someone else, and that you knew ASL, that, you know.
Yeah, and that's a great point. And it's one that I didn't realize until after I actually published the first children's book, was that we don't do a great job, and we as growing up, of telling people what we appreciate about them, right? Mm-hmm. And as that was coming out, and I started getting reviews from old high school classmates or old college, the reality was is there was some appreciation that I underestimated back when I was actually going through it. So what you speak of is, hey, they actually did find it was neat and interesting. It just didn't come across that way when you're young.
Yeah.
Now it's when people grow and mature, myself and the world around us, it's enlightening, and it's great to hear.
I wonder, you talk also about something that's a stressor in your family. One of the stressor was money matters. And I think that is fascinating because that's not, I mean, this is like every family that I know that has, you know, money trouble, regardless if you have a disability or if you're deaf or not. But you say that this is actually a fairly large problem in the deaf community. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. So from a perspective of, context is important. My parents, they worked, over 75 years in combined at the same company. And so they were hardworking people, on time, did their jobs well, and but they didn't make a lot of money, right? And, you know, I grew up in rural America, and, you know, there's not a ton of money there as it is to start with. But then you layer on top of the, and it continues to evolve, right? But there's this stigma out there that deaf people cannot do certain jobs. And the reality behind it is, and that's the name of my children's book series, the Deaf Kids Can series. Deaf kids, deaf adults can do anything hearing people can do except for hear, right? And because of that, it's one of those things where there have not been a lot of roles or positions made available to deaf and no hard of hearing people.
Mm-hmm.
Because of that, and because of that, there have been some, you know, it's a very deep topic to get into, but there's sometimes the deafness is not the only potential disability. There's often layers to it. There's a term out there, it's called Deaf Plus. So there's various things that could play into it, but the reality behind it is job placement is a struggle for the community. Job consistency, you name it. But from an employee perspective, I've seen it where my parents' friends and my parents themselves,
mm-hmm.
some of the hardest working people that their companies have. So, you know, if I sat here today and had an opportunity with a role that fits, I strongly consider a very loyal and hardworking deaf person.
I am curious what kind of role. You had a sibling, a younger sister, I believe, and I'm wondering what kind of role did she play with the dealings of the Hearing Society while you were growing up, and how did that change when you went to college?
Yeah, so that's actually it's a very centered piece in one of the chapters about that time in life. So as the eldest born child, the way of interpreting, I was the strongest signer in the family. I was the one that was able to step into any situation. And because of that, my sister, she can always take a back seat. Now, if she was out by herself with my parents, could she do it? Yes, but it wasn't as strong, as fluid, and didn't have that presence that I did.
Mm.
Fast forward, she's 2 years behind me in school, and I went away to college, and the chapter in there is pretty insightful, where I went away, and there was this tug of war between my father and I about staying at the college I was at or moving back home, because it weighed heavily on him that he had lost his main, his son, interpreter, and he was still adapting to my sister interpreting for him. So it was a growth experience all the way around for the entire family.
Yeah, I'm sure that is correct. You talk a lot about your changes that you had in your first year of college. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I went to a very small liberal arts college in Western Michigan, and it was about 2.5-3 hours away from my hometown, and it was in what I refer to as Big City. I'm still in that area to this day, but picked up, moved over there, thought I was going to go there and play baseball.
Mm.
I had a root canal the first weekend I was there. I missed out on a cool event that the school has. Then my high school sweetheart at that time dumped me. And then I got cut from the baseball team, all within a period of 3 to 4 months. And then I launch into what that phone call sounded like in that experience within that chapter. And those really built out. That was the inflection point between me staying in the West Michigan area or me going back. So that was a very pivotal phone call and decision I made to stick it out. And I haven't looked back since.
And your high school sweetheart, she was going to the same college you were, right?
She was a year ahead of me. She's been blessed with a great family. It's great to see that both of us came out of that just fine.
Mm, yes. Well, I think that's often a case where one follows another to their college and surprise, because people always grow and change. I would have thought that, I mean, you had so much on your shoulders growing up. I don't want to lessen that, because being the pivotal person in the house to communicate for your parents is a heavy, heavy weight, as much as a privilege. But you talk about there was other things that you just were not as experienced with and that helped you grow. Can you tell us some of those in college?
So, in college. So, look, it was first time away from home. My mom was, for lack of a better term, a very traditional mother and wife. Dinner every night. Did our laundry. I was spoiled. I didn't realize that until I moved away. But some of the things I learned is that, you know, people have to grow and evolve. And I realized that at that point in time, my parents were, they didn't know how to be parents, just like all of us, didn't know how to be parents, right? Yeah. You learn how to parent as you evolve, but how your children evolve. Those are some of the things that have stuck out to me there.
I'm wondering, a touchy subject, I think, for some people is if you're deaf, do you have a disability? I know there's a split, I feel like, in the deaf community that, just like anything, some don't think that that's a disability and others do. As a hearing person, where do you, and somebody who's actually grown up and lived in it, where do you sit with that?
So, first of all, my position on it is that I have no right to tell, as a hearing person, to tell a deaf person or hard of hearing person how they choose to identify. I'm very self-conscious about that piece. Like, there are certain battles that while I can be an ally and I can help, it is not my true battle. And to say that I understand it wholeheartedly, I can't, because I haven't walked in their shoes. But what I can tell you from being very, very close to it is my parents never viewed themselves as disabled, never took advantage of that piece, or an advantage is a bad word, because there is there are some things that you can get assistance or what have you, and sure, a lot of folks would need it, right? But at the same time, they took,
I talk about it in my book, my father was a registered high school umpire and official for 30 years.
There is a communication gap that he had to work through, and he faced that head on. But back, to your original point in your question, my position on it is the fact that however the person wants to identify, if they want to identify themselves as disabled in some form or fashion, that is totally their choice and their opinion. If they choose to not call themselves, disabled or anything like that, that's their choice. I applaud anyone who takes a position on it. And the one thing that's really unique, when I was growing up, it's often called like an invisible disability, right? Now the correct term, and is not a apparent disability, because I tell people, unless my mother and I were standing right next to each other and turned to start signing to each other, you would have zero clue that my mother was deaf.
Right.
So to me, that is the biggest thing that really launches into the advocacy of all of these nonprofit organizations that try to support the deaf community, is that people, they can see homelessness, they can see food poverty, they can see all of these different things, but it's tougher for them to see the disability and the impact of deaf and hard of hearing. So that's what I've really tried to bring to the forefront to the nonprofit Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services here in West Michigan, is just to get the word out, educate whoever I can on the positive culture that this deaf community has.
Well, I expect that that's the same with anyone with a hidden disability, right? There's plenty of hidden disabilities that you just can't see.
Correct.
Unless they were doing a specific task that was difficult for them. You speak on professional signers, and you kind of just grew into it. What are some of the differences between you as a non-professional, and you're probably, I'm sure that you're as good as a professional now, between you growing up and a professional signer?
Yeah, so this is, you've actually hit on a chapter where I actually probably could have taken deeper. In fact, there was a very critical review of the book about that chapter and recently posted. And while I didn't like it whatsoever, but it was great feedback, right? I'm a fan of big positive reviews. So for those of you that want to leave a positive review, that's great. But this was very important because that is the one chapter that I have the biggest reflection on. I could have done it differently. I really made that chapter feel as if POTAs and professional interpreters are different. And in fact, there are plenty of POTAs that are fantastic interpreters. In fact, those are usually the best type because they grew up as a first language doing
right.
Well, I kind of make it sound as if you need to be a professional, and I'm over here. I chose not to be. So one of the big things that I struggle with personally, and one of the things why I haven't gotten certified, is I struggle compartmentalizing in the environment. I am so used to advocating for my mother and my father in a doctor's appointment. Where if you're a professional interpreter bound by the code of ethics, you have to interpret every single thing, right? There is no quote unquote stepping out of role. That's what's to advise the patient. There isn't any of that. So that is the main thing that I would struggle with. But the other piece is, and this is a reflection that was pointed out to me over the holidays. My mother got my children these American Sign Language flashcards as a gift. And my daughter was going through them, and I was getting some of them wrong. And I said, wait a minute, I've been doing this my entire life. How am I getting these signs wrong? Well, I'm a lazy signer, okay? I've grown up being able to communicate just fine with my parents and the community that I was raised in, where I did not put the technical aspect into it as much as I should have. I can tell you there are phenomenal code interpreters out there. And the chapter you speak of, admittedly, I probably could have done a better job on that one. And if there are code interpreters or heritage signers out there that read that and are offended by it, please understand that I acknowledge it. I probably could have wrote it slightly different.
I have to tell you, when you were talking about getting a sign wrong, one of my favorite parts in your book was an argument you lost with your young daughter. Can you retell that story for me?
Yeah, so my daughter, she is smart. Both my children, I've been blessed with smart children. And my daughter was watching the show Mika. It's a spinoff of the Blippi series. And for those with young kids, everybody will understand who that is. And Mika was going through and teaching the different colors versus American Sign Language. And I told my daughter, I was quizzing my daughter, and I did the sign for purple. And she said, no, that's wrong. And so I had to go and look. And sure enough, I was wrong. So I dialed up my mother on FaceTime.
When in doubt.
Yeah, and I said, wait a minute. She goes, well, there's two ways to do it. I'm like, oh, okay. So now, not only did I get called out on it, we give my mother a hard time for teaching us some of the incorrect signs too.
Always good when you can blame it on the parent. At least that's what one of my children tells me. I wonder if you could talk about the importance or not of a name sign and tell us what that means.
Yeah, so in the deaf culture, rather than spelling out your name all of the time, there's been a shortcut taken where you're given a name sign or a sign name, however you want, whatever you want to call it. And it can only be given to you by a deaf person. That's the unwritten, unspoken, now I just spoke it rule, that the deaf person has to give you the name sign. Well, the first time I realized, wait a minute, I don't have a name sign, was when I was conversing. I had moved over to the west side, and I got involved with the agency here, and I was having a conversation mm-hmm. with one of the deaf leaders, and they asked me what my name sign was. I said, what are you talking about? And so they looked at me, and my credibility took an immediate hit. Like, wait a minute, this guy's saying he's a CODA, but he doesn't have a name sign. What gives? And then I asked my mother about it. Well, the origin of the story goes back to when my mother, she went to a school for the deaf in Michigan, in Flint, Michigan. And my mother's maiden name last name started with a J. Her first name started with a B. And she said, I never accepted a name sign because kids were so cruel. With my initials, that she just never did. So then,
obvious for reasons.
So she had never thought to give me a name sign. And I just, now it's kind of like a badge of honor, kind of like if you've never smoked a cigarette in your life, you just stick it there. You know, if people want to give me a name sign, make it easier on myself, have at it. But right now, I don't have an official one.
Your sister had a name sign.
Yeah. The funny part about that, though, is it was basically the sign of baby. So we had fun with that one a little bit.
Yeah. And your father had a name sign as well.
Yes. His was, his first name started with S. So he would take, he'd make the sign for S in his hand, and then he'd trace on his chest an S, like Superman. Mm. So that was his go-to superhero, the Superman, and that's how his name sign came to be.
Yeah. So are you okay with not having one? I mean, does that sit well with you now?
Yeah, I'm fine with it now. I look back at it and I say, oh, it'd be cool to have one. But the reality behind it, based off of my name, I'm guessing it would have been centered something around, Mickey Mouse or something. So it's probably better off that I didn't have one. So I will always be curious what it would be. Mm. But yes, it's I'm okay with it.
I'd like to talk about something that I'm sure is that comes to fruition with any family that has a CODA that lives with them or grows up in the household, and that is when the children leave the nest. How do things change for the two parents that maybe are non-hearing or hard of hearing and non-hearing? What were the changes in your family, and how did your parents adapt?
Yeah, so a lot of that I didn't visually see, to be frank, because the reality was that I was 2.5-3 hours away. So they really had to dust off their independence from the perspective of communicating. They had to go back and rely more on the actual interpreter relay system for making phone calls. So they really had to dust some of that off. But I can tell you, and this goes for a lot of folks, they were so involved with our extracurricular activities that they had to find stuff to do, right? And so my mom got back into knitting and macrame. My father did more officiating. So they faced similar problems as other empty nesters did. But I tell you, one thing they really capitalized on, they visited all 50 states before my father passed.
Oh, wow.
They were big cruisers. There's actually a travel agency that coordinates deaf cruises quite a bit, where they'll hire a bunch of different interpreters, bring on, and, a whole sea of deaf people will be on the ship. And my parents really enjoyed going on those.
Mm-hmm. Were there lessons, and are there lessons you pass on to your children that you feel, you know, since you grew up in a deaf household, that you feel maybe that hearing parents don't pass on?
So my wife and I are trying to learn how to be parents just like everybody else, right? Mm. And I spoke about that earlier. But I will tell you, one of the things that I think, maybe we don't talk about it enough, however, they have enough exposure to their grandmother who lives nearby that they understand the importance of inclusion. Okay, they understand, to them, grandma is just grandma, right? They understand they have to communicate differently with her. And I will tell you, I can see it in my daughter through and through that she has this great care and nurturing about her with friends and classmates at school that might need a little extra support, right? And she's very inclusive when it comes to that. She is very so from that angle, the inclusion piece is the biggest thing that I think that we're really imparting on them. That's a carryover from being, they're grandchildren of deaf adults, right? And I'm so glad that they're able to have more exposure to my mother to be able to see that directly and have it carry over into their lives.
Mm, yes. I wonder, Mickey, what do you want the average person or non-average to take away from this book?
So there's a couple of things that I want them to take away. I want them to take away first the positivity that lies within the deaf community and being raised in a household that had English as a second language. That's number one. When I look around at peer groupings, there's a lot of negativity centered around the books and the storylines. My sole purpose was to yell from the rooftops the positivity that there was and how I was raised. That's number one. The second piece is understanding and having a little bit of empathy as to what different people go through and understanding that, hey, when you work with someone who's either been raised by deaf adults or a deaf person, maybe you'll educate yourself a little bit through these stories and these lessons. And then the third piece that I really want to impress upon is the ability for us to become more inclusive and accept them. So I wrote it from a positive perspective, and then I wanted to educate, and then I wanted to include.
Yes. I do feel, I must say, that I guess I feel like you really contemplated over the lessons you learned growing up by reading this book. I could almost see that. And it feels like you were very humbled by your experiences. And I found it awesome, you know, some of the lessons that you had learned and imparted in the book and were great. It didn't matter, you know, it's a great lesson to talk about growing up with deafness. But even if you don't have experience with deafness, reading this book has super valuable lessons with treating people and running a company in general. And it feels like you got a ton of experience learning about things like that when you were climbing the ladder in your companies.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at it and you peel back the onion, some of the situations that I deal with in the current role or as I progressed within the company really happened to me when I was 6 years old, 8 years old, 12 years old. I was immersed in some of those negotiations early on. So I was no stranger to some of that. Now it's a matter of what can I take from the lessons that I've learned and apply it? And how does that influence the way I lead? I'm big, real big, on the culture of my team and making sure that while there's different dynamics and different noises around the world, intra-company, you name it, I'm very, very big on controlling what we can control within the team that I lead. So that's the big influence that I have from my parents is they had zero control over their deafness.
Right.
So what could they control?
Right.
Hold what they controlled, and that is carried over into how I can lead.
So is there any other big things you feel like you learned about yourself in during the writing of this book?
You learn a lot when you write a book. It is therapy. It is, it is eye-opening. It can dust off potentially some, a lot of great memories. It can dust off some memories that were tucked away in the closet for good reason. You name it, right? But for those that are contemplating writing a book, understand that the entire journey of emotions they are going to happen. But realize this, every single person has a story to tell. That is one of the things, there's a lot of folks that say, I'd love to write a book. And then they say, but I don't know what, my story is just general. I don't know what would be out there. Mm-hmm. And every single person has a uniqueness to their story. But just understand, when you start to write it, that uniqueness is going to come out. Good, bad, ugly, you name it, right? So that was the biggest learning for me is how therapeutic and it really was.
Obviously, during the time when you were a child and now, there's been, if you think of all the things that have changed, a huge change in technology. But I'm curious to know what kind of advice you would give a child of deaf parents growing up in your situation today.
So the first piece would be to embrace it. And then the next piece would be to lead, live, and love. And I say all that, and it's taken in part from the subtitle of my book, but you have an opportunity to be a leader, and you have more opportunities to be in situations where you can develop those leadership moments. You may think it's corny, and you may not want to hear about it when you're 13 years old, but I guarantee you, another 13-year-old is not going to be in situations that you're going to be in. And then you take it a step further. Live your life. You've got your parents. They're deaf. Live your life. They want what's best for you. They want you to be a productive person in society, and they want you to grow up. They want you to love. And then that's the third piece. Love your parents. Just as much as they love you. That's the one thing I look back at my teenage years. I was a good kid by all intents and purposes, but some of the pushback that I gave my parents, they didn't deserve that. And when I look at it, if you're a CODA listening to this, I'd encourage you to learn how unique and cool your situation is earlier than I did. Like I said, it took me 40 plus years and the loss of my father to realize, wait a minute, that was a cool experience. That's what I say to the younger generation.
How can one get your book?
It's available all over the place. You can grab it from your local independent bookstore. They can order it from a wholesale distributor. You can grab it from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million. It's all over the place. I've got my website, MickeyCarolyn.com. where I do book speaking engagements, author visits, you name it.
What have people said to you after reading your book?
The first thing
I'm sure you've gotten all kinds of things, but what are just some of the top things?
They told me they underestimated how funny some of the stories were. And I go back to, I used a laugh-laugh-cry model. So I tried to take the journey people through roller coaster emotions. I will tell you that, you know, my sister read it, and she, because she's much closer to the book, you know, had some teary-eyed moments in it. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that there's been other folks that they learned what a Kona was. They learned they took what pieces of access that they took for granted. So there's been a lot of learnings from it, and a whole lot of respect from people that I took it upon myself to share the story.
I'm wondering what your mom thought, and did she have any feeling of that she leaned too heavily on you growing up?
So she would say that the teenage years were the problem, right? She would acknowledge that that's when I started to feel the weight of it. That's when I started to push back and not handle myself properly. But
you wouldn't be the first teenager, by the way.
Right. And I don't, she hasn't said much about it. She doesn't feel terrible about it. But I bet you if you were to ask her point blank, she would say, yeah, you know, she didn't want to always have to put me in those situations. It was just, that's how it was.
Mm. Yes. She did read it, right?
Yes. Yep.
Oh, okay.
She's low vision now. She's got diabetes. Mm-hmm. It's impacted her sight. And mm-hmm. She has to use this big old magnifier computer screen to read it. But she has read it.
Charlene, I'm wondering if you have any thoughts or any questions for Mickey in regarding his book or anything else?
It was a very interesting book, and I want to share one quick story. I worked for the veterans in North Chicago, and I had one gentleman one day. He had dementia, and we were singing, and he still remembered how to sign. Both parents were deaf, and he still knew how to sign the Christmas songs. It was just really a really deep moment for me. I was, you know, it was just amazing.
Mickey, can you give your website one more time for us?
Yes, gladly. It is MickeyCaroline.com, MickeyKey, and then CaroLan.com.
I want to thank you so much for being on and sharing your story. And I really encourage people to read this because it holds so many great lessons in regards to managing teams and managing partnerships. And I really found it very valuable. So thank you so much. And good luck in the future.
It was my pleasure, and I'm so grateful you had me on. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mickey. This has been Disability and Progress. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of KFAI or its board of directors. My name is Sam. I've been the host of this show. Miguel was my engineer. Charlene is my PR person. And Aaron is my podcaster. We've been speaking with Mickey Carolyn, the author of Mom, Dad, Not Here, HEAR. This is KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org. If you'd like to send me an email, you may email me at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. Meanwhile, thanks for listening and join us next time. Goodbye.
KFAI.org.